The white shirts and I agree. Carlyle's hands come free. Akarat is called away by an army officer. Carlyle pulls off his gag. We friends again? Anderson shrugs, watching the activity around them. As much as anyone in a revolution can be. How you doing? Anderson touches his chest gingerly. Broken ribs? He nods at his hand where the doctor is splinting his finger. Busted finger. Think my jaw's okay. He shrugs. You? Better than that. I think my shoulder sprained, but I wasn't the one who introduced the rogue windup. Anderson coughs and winces. Yeah, well, lucky you. One of the army people is cranking a radio phone, gears ratcheting. Akarat takes a call.
Yes.
He nods, speaks in Thai. Anderson can only catch a few words, but Carlyle's eyes widen as he listens. They're taking the radio stations, he whispers. What? Anderson scrambles to his feet, wincing, pushing aside the doctor still working on his hand. Guards lunge in front of him, blocking him from Akarat. Anderson calls over their shoulders as they shove him back against the wall.
You're starting. Now?
Akarat glances up from his phone, finishes his conversation calmly, and hands the receiver back to his communications officer. The winding man settles back on his haunches, waiting for the next call. The flywheel hum slows. Akarat says, The Samdet Chow Phraya's assassination has brought out a great deal of hostility for the White Shirts. Protests outside the Environment Ministry. Even the Megadont Union is involved. People were already angry at the Ministry's crackdowns. I have decided we will capitalize on this. But we don't have our assets in place. Anderson protests. You don't have all your army units down from the northeast. My strike teams aren't supposed to be ashore for another week. Akarat shrugs and smiles. Revolutions are a messy business. It is better to take the opportunities that come before us. Still, I think that you will be pleasantly surprised. He turns back to his hand-cranked radiophone. The steady whir of the flywheel fills the room as Akarat talks to people under his command. Anderson watches Akarat's back. The man, once so obsequious in the presence of the Samdet Chow Phraya, is now in charge. He issues orders in a steady stream. Every so often, the phone buzzes again for attention. This is crazy, Carlyle murmurs. Are we still in it at all? Hard to say. Akarat glances over at them, seems about to say something, but instead, he cocks his head. Listen, he says. His voice has become reverent. A rumble rolls across the city. Through the command post's open windows. Light flares briefly, like lightning in a storm. Akarat smiles. It's starting. Chapter 39 Pai is waiting for Kanya in her office when she comes bursting in. Where are the men? She asks, panting.
They were formed up in the bachelor's housing. He shrugs. We came back from the village when we heard things were...
Are they still there?
Maybe some of them. I heard Akarat and Pracha were going to negotiate.
No!
She shakes her head.
Get them now!
She's rushing around the room, grabbing extra spring gun clips.
Get them formed up and armed. We don't have much time.
Pai stares at Hiroko.
Is that the windup?
Don't worry about her. Do you know where General Pracha is?
He shrugs. I heard he inspected our walls, and then he was going to speak with the Megadont Union about the protests. She grimaces.
Get the men formed up. We can't wait anymore.
You're crazy.
An explosion shakes the ground. Outside, trees crackle as they crash to the ground. Pi leaps to his feet, a look of shock on his face. He runs to the window and stares outside. A warning klaxon starts to sound.
It's trade, Kanya says.
They're already here.
She grabs her spring gun. Hiroko is preternaturally still, standing with her head cocked, as though she is some sort of dog listening. And then she turns slightly, her attention leaning forward, anticipatory.
Another series of explosions rock the compound. The entire building shudders. Plaster crackles off the ceiling.
Kanya rushes out of her office. Other white shirts stream out with her. Those few who were working evening shifts or who hadn't yet been assigned to patrol and containment on the docks and anchor pads. She dashes down the hall, followed closely by Hiroko and Pai, and charges outside. The night has the scent of jasmine flowers, sweet and strong, along with the smell of smoke and the tang of something else, something she has not smelled since military convoys rolled across the ancient Friendship Bridge, over the Mekong, and on toward the insurgents in Vietnam. A tank smashes through the outer walls. It is a metal monster, taller than two men, jungle-mottled and belching smoke from its furnace. Its main gun fires. The muzzle flashes, and the tank heaves back on its treads. Its turret swivels, gears clanking, choosing another target. Masonry and marble shower down over Kanya. She dives for cover. Behind the tank, war megadonts rush through the gap. Their tusks glint in the darkness. Their riders are all in black. In the dimness, the few white shirts who have come out to defend the compound stand out like pale ghosts, easy targets. The whine of high-capacity springs comes from atop the megadonts, and then the chatter of discs slashing all around her. Concrete chips rain down. Kanya's cheek opens. Suddenly, she is lying on the ground, buried under the weight of Hiroko, who has shoved her down as more spring gun discs slash the air and crackle against the walls behind her. Another explosion. The noise fills her whole head. She realizes that she is whimpering. Sounds have suddenly become distant. She's shaking with fear. The tank rumbles into the center of the courtyard. Rotates. More megadonts pour through, their feet tangled in a wave of shock troops also rushing the gap. It's too far away to even make out which general has decided to betray Pracha. Scattered small arms spit from the upper stories of the ministry buildings. Screams echo. Ministry people dying. Kanya pulls out her spring gun and takes aim. Beside her, a records clerk takes a disc and falls. Kanya holds her pistol carefully, fires a shot. Can't tell if it hits her man or not. Fires again. Sees him fall. The mass of troops flowing toward her is like a tsunami. Jaidi appears at her shoulder.
What about your men? He asks. Are you going to sell yourself so easily and neglect those boys who rely on you?
Kanya pulls the trigger again. She can barely see. She is crying. Men are spreading across the courtyards, squads leapfrogging under covering fire.
Please, Captain Kanya, Hiroko begs. We must run.
Go, Jaidi urges. It's too late to fight.
Kanya lets her finger off the trigger. Discs chatter around her. She rolls and scrambles for the doorway, lunges back into the relative safety of the building. Scrambles to her feet and runs for the exit at the opposite side of the building. More shells hit. The building shakes. She wonders if it will collapse before she makes the far side. Memories from her childhood flutter as she jumps bloody bodies following Hiroko and Pai. Memories of destruction and horror. Of coal-burning tanks roaring through villages, screaming down the remaining paved roads of the provinces in long columns before plowing out across rice paddies. Tanks running hard and fast for the Mekong. Their treads tearing up the earth on their way to defend the kingdom from the first surprise incursions of the Vietnamese. Black smoke roiling in their wake as they went to hold the border. And now the monsters are here. She burst through the far side of the ministry and into a firestorm. Trees burning, some sort of napalm strike. Smoke roils around her. Another tank smashes a distant gate, coming faster than any megadont. It is difficult for her mind to process how quickly they move. They are like tigers streaking across the grounds. Men fire their spring guns, but they are nothing against the iron shells of the tanks. They are not built for warfare. The chatter of weapons fire rattles along with bright flashes of light. Silvery discs chatter all around, bouncing and slashing. White shirts run for cover, but they have no place to go. Red blossoms on white. Men are disassembled by explosions. More tanks pour through.
"Who are they?"
Pai screams. Kanya shakes her head dumbly. The armored division ravages through the burning trees of the Environment Ministry's grounds. More troops are pouring in. They have to be from the northeast. Akarat is making his move. Racha has been betrayed. She yanks at Pai, points him toward a slight rise, and the shadows of unburned trees pointing toward where the Prasub temple may still be standing. Perhaps they can escape. Pai stares but doesn't move. Kanya yanks him again, and then they are off and running across the grounds. Palm trees crash down in their path, crackling and flaming. Coconuts rain green around them along with shrapnel bursts. The screams of men and women being torn apart by the well-oiled military machine fill the air.
"Where now?"
Pai yells. Kanya doesn't have an answer. She ducks as wood splinters shower her and dives behind the partial cover of a fallen burning palm. Jaidi flops down beside her and grins, not even sweating. He peers over the top of the log, then glances back at Kanya. "So, who will you fight for now, Captain?" Chapter 40. The tank surprises them all. One moment, they are riding a pair of cycle rickshaws down a nearly empty street. The next, a roaring fills the air, and a tank bursts into the intersection ahead. It has a loudspeaker that squawks something, perhaps a warning, and then its turret spins in their direction.
"Hide!"
Hak-sung shouts as they all try to scramble off their bikes. The tank's barrel roars. Hak-sung hits the ground. A building face collapses, showering them with debris. Clouds of gray dust billow over him. Hak-sung coughs and tries to get up and crawl away, but a rifle chatters, and he throws himself flat again. He can't see anything in the dust. Answering small arms fire crackles from a nearby building, and then the tank is firing again. The smoke clears slightly. From an alley, laughing Chan waves for Hak-sung. His hair is powdered gray, and his face is coated with dust. His mouth moves, but no sound comes out. Hak-sung tugs at Pak Eng, and they scramble for safety. The hatch of the tank pops open, and an armored gunner appears, firing with a spring rifle. Pak Eng goes down, his chest blossoming red. Peter Kwok ducks into an alley, and Hak-sung glimpses him running. Hak-sung dives flat again and worms himself into the rubble. The tank fires again, rocking back on its treads. More small arms fire chatters from somewhere down the street. The man in the turret flops forward, dead.
His rifle slides down the tank's armor. The tank engages and spins on its treads, clanking. Garbage and leaflets swirl around it. It lurches toward Hak Sung and accelerates. Hak Sung lunges aside as the tank crashes past, showering him with more debris. Laughing, Chan stares after the retreating vehicle. He says something, but Hak Sung's ears are still ringing. He waves for Hak Sung to join him again. Hak Sung staggers upright and stumbles into the soy's relative safety. Laughing, Chan cups his hands around Hak Sung's ear. His shout is a whisper.
It's fast! Faster than a megadont!
Hak Sung nods. He's shaking. It appeared so suddenly. So much faster than anything he has ever seen. Old expansion technology. And the men driving it seemed mad. Hak Sung looks around at the rubble.
I don't even know what they were doing here. There's nothing to secure, he says.
Laughing Chan suddenly begins to laugh. His distant words tunnel past the ringing in Hak Sung's ears.
Maybe they're lost!
And then they are both laughing, and Hak Sung is almost hysterical with relief. They sit in the alley, resting and trying to catch their breath and giggling. Slowly, Hak Sung's hearing returns.
It's worse than the green headbands,
Laughing Chan says, looking out of the street wreckage.
At least with them it was personal.
He makes a face. You could fight them. These ones are too fast and too crazy. Fangle, all of them.
Hak Sung is inclined to agree.
Still, dead is dead. I would rather not face either.
We'll have to be more careful,
Laughing Chan says. He nods at Pak Eng's body.
What should we do about him? Do you want to carry him back to the towers?
Hak Sung asks pointedly.
Chan shakes his head, grimacing.
Another explosion rumbles. From the sound of it, it's no more than a few blocks away. Hak Sung looks up.
The tank again?
Let's not wait to find out!
They set off down the street, keeping to doorways. A few others are out in the open, looking toward the rumbling explosions, trying to see where the noises are coming from, to see what is happening. Hak Sung remembers standing on a similar street only a few years before. The scent of the sea and the promise of the monsoon brightened the air the day the green headband started their cleansing. And on that day, too, people had looked up like pigeons, head swiveling toward the sound of slaughter, suddenly aware that they were in danger. Ahead, unmistakable, the chatter of spring guns. Hak Sung motions to Laughing Chan and they turn into a new alley. He's too old for this foolishness. He should be reclining on a couch, smoking a bowl of opium, while a pretty fifth wife massages his ankles. Behind them, the rest of the people on the street are still standing out in the open, still staring toward the sounds of battle. The Thais don't know what to do. Not yet. They have no experience with true slaughter. Their reflexes are wrong. Hak Sung turns into an abandoned building.
Where are you going?
Laughing Chan asks.
I want to see. I need to know what's happening.
He climbs. One stairwell, two stairwells, three, four, he's panting, five, six, then out into a hall. Broken doors, stifling close heat, the smell of excrement. Another explosion rumbles distant. Through an open window, tracers of fire arc across the darkening sky and boom in the distance. Small arms snap and chatter in the streets like spring festival fireworks. Smoke pillars rise from a dozen points in the city, nagas coiling, black against the setting sun, the anchor pads, the sea locks, the manufacturing district, The Environment Ministry. Laughing Chan grabs Hak Sung's shoulder and points. Hak Sung sucks in his breath. The Yawarat slum blazes. Weather all shanties exploding in a spreading curtain of flame.
Water, Tian.
Laughing Chan murmurs.
We won't be going back there.
Hak Sung stares at the burning slum that had been his home, watching with horror as all his cash and gems turn to ash. Fate is fickle. He laughs wearily.
And you thought I wasn't lucky. We'd be roasted like pigs by now if we had stayed.
Laughing Chan makes a mock whine at him.
I will follow the Lord of the Three Prosperities into the Nine Hells.
He pauses.
But what do we do now?
Hak Sung points.
We follow Tanon Rama the 12th, and then...
He doesn't see the missile strike. It's too fast for any human being's eyes. Perhaps a military wind-up would have time to prepare, but he and Laughing Chan are thrown off their feet by the shockwave. A building collapses across the street.
Never mind!
Laughing Chan grabs Hak Sung and drags him back toward the safety of the stairwells.
We'll work it out! I don't want to lose my head for the sake of your view!
Newly cautious, they slip through the darkening streets, working their way toward the manufacturing district. The streets are becoming more deserted as the Thais finally learn there is no safety in the open.
What's that?
Laughing Chan whispers. Hak Sung squints into the gloom. A trio of men crouch around a hand-cranked radio. One of them has an antenna in his hands that he holds over his head, trying to get reception. Hak Sung slows to walk, then urges Laughing Chan across the street to them.
What? News?
Hak Sung puffs.
Did you see that missile hit?
One of them asks. He looks up.
Yellow cards,
he murmurs. His companions exchange glances as they catch sight of Laughing Chan's machete, then smile nervously and start to shy away. Hak Sung sketches a clumsy Y.
We just want the noose.
One of them spits betel nut, still watching suspiciously, but he says,
It's Akarat on the air.
He gestures for them to listen. His friend lifts the antenna again, pulling in static.
Stay indoors. Do not go outside. General Pracha and his white shirts have attempted to topple Her Royal Majesty the Queen herself. It is our duty to defend the realm.
The voice crackles out of reception, and the man begins fiddling with the knobs and the wireless again. One of them shakes his head.
It's all lies.
The one doing the tuning murmurs a disagreement.
But the Samde Chao Praya.
Akarat would kill Rama himself if he saw a benefit.
Their friend lowers the antenna. The radio hisses static, and the transmission is lost entirely as he speaks.
I had a white shirt in my shop the other day, and he wanted to take my daughter home with him. A gift of goodwill, he called it.
They're all monitor lizards.
A little corruption is one thing, but these Hia will...
Another explosion shakes the ground. Everyone turns, ties and yellow cards together, trying to fix on the location.
We're like little monkeys trying to understand a huge jungle.
The thought frightens Hak Sung. They're piecing together clues, but they have nothing to provide context. No matter how much they learn, it can never be enough. They can only react to events as they unfold and hope for luck.
Hak Sung tugs Laughing Chan's arm. Let's go.
The Thais are already hurriedly gathering the radio and ducking back into their shop. When Hak Sung looks back again, The street corner is entirely empty. As if the moment of political discussion hadn't existed at all. The fighting worsens as they near the manufacturing district. The Environment Ministry and the Army seem to be everywhere, warring. And for every professional unit on the street, there are others. The volunteers and student associations, and civilians and loyalists, mobilized by political factions. Hak-sung pauses in a doorway, panting, as explosions and rifle fire echo. "I can't tell any of them apart," Laughing Chan mutters, as a group of university students, carrying short machetes and wearing yellow armbands, runs past, headed for a tank that's busy shelling an old expansion tower.
"They're all wearing yellow. Everyone wants to claim loyalty to the Queen. Does she even exist?"
Hak-sung shrugs. A student's spring gun blades bounce off the tank's armor. The thing is huge. Hak-sung can't help being impressed that the army has successfully loaded so many tanks into the capital. He supposes the Navy and its admirals provided assistance, which means General Pracha and his white shirts have no allies left.
"They're all crazy,"
Hak-sung mutters. "It doesn't make any difference who is who." He studies the street. His knee is hurting, his old injury making him slow.
"I wish we could find some bicycles. My leg," he grimaces. "If you were on a bike, shooting you would be as easy as shooting a grandmother on a stoop."
Hak-sung rubs his knee.
"Still, I'm too old for this."
Rubble showers them from another explosion. Laughing Chan brushes debris out of his hair.
"I hope this is worth the trip."
"You could be back in the slums, roasting alive."
"That's true,"
Laughing Chan nods.
"But let's hurry. I don't want to keep testing our luck."
More dark intersections. More violence. Rumors flying on the streets. Executions in Parliament. The Trade Ministry in flames. Thammasat University students rallying on behalf of the Queen. And then another radio broadcast. A new frequency, everyone says, as they all huddle around the tinny speaker. The announcer sounds shaken. Hak-sung wonders if there is a spring gun at her head. Kun Subawati. She was always so popular. Always introduced such interesting radio plays. And now her voice trembles as she begs her countrymen to stay calm while tanks rush through the streets, securing everything from the anchor pads to the docks. The radio speaker crackles with the sound of shelling and explosions. A few seconds later, explosions rumble in the distance like muffled thunder, a perfect echo of the ones on the radio.
"She's closer to the fighting than we are,"
Laughing Chan says.
"Is that a good sign or a bad one?"
Hak-sung wonders. Laughing Chan starts to answer, but a Megadon's screams of rage interrupt, followed by the whine of spring guns unleashing. Everyone looks down the street.
"That sounds bad."
"Hide,"
Hak-sung says.
"Too late."
A wave of people pours around the corner, running and screaming. A trio of carbon-armored Megadons thunders behind them. The massive heads sweep low, slashing from side to side. Their tusks slash through the fleeing people with attached scythe blades. Bodies split like oranges and fly like leaves. From atop the Megadons, machine gun cages open fire. Flickering silver streams of bladed discs pour into the packed crowd. Hak-sung and Laughing Chan crouch in a doorway as people flee past. The white shirts in their midst fire their own spring guns and single-shot rifles as they run, but the discs are entirely ineffective against the armored Megadons. The Environment Ministry isn't equipped for this sort of warfare. Ricocheting ammunition flurries around them as the machine guns chatter. People collapse in bloody, writhing piles, howling agony as the Megadons trample over them. Dust and smoke and musk choke the street. A man is flung aside by a Megadont and slams into Hak Sung. Blood gouts from his mouth, but he is already dead. Hak Sung crawls out from under the corpse. More people are forming up and firing at the Megadonts. Students, Hak Sung thinks. Perhaps from Tamasat. But it's impossible to tell who they are loyal to. And Hak Sung wonders if even they know who they are fighting. The Megadonts wheel and charge. People pile up against Hak Sung, trying to get out of the way. Their mass crushes him. He can't breathe. He tries to cry out, to clear space for himself, but the crush is too great. He screams. The weight of desperate people fleeing presses down upon him, squeezing out the last of his air. The Megadont sweeps into them. It backs and charges again, tearing into the clot of people, swinging its bladed tusks. Students throw bottles of oil up at the Megadonts and hurl torches up after, spinning lights and fire. More razor discs rain down. Hak Sung cowers as the guns sweep toward him, spitting silver. A boy stares into his eyes, yellow headband slipped down over his bleeding face. Hak Sung's leg blossoms with pain. He can't tell if he's shot or if his knee is broken. He screams in frustration and fear. The weight of bodies pushes him to the ground. He's going to die, crushed under the dead. Despite everything, he failed to understand the capriciousness of warfare. In his arrogance, he thought he could prepare. Such a fool. Silence comes suddenly. His ears are ringing, but there's no more weapons fire and no more trumpeting Megadonts. Hak Sung takes a shuddering breath beneath the weight of bodies. All around him he hears only moans and sobbing.
Achan!
He calls. No answer. Hak Sung claws his way out. Others are dragging themselves free of the massacre as well, helping their wounded. Hak Sung can barely stand. His leg is awash with pain. He's covered with blood. He searches through the bodies trying to find Laughing Chan, but if the man is in the pile, he is covered in too much blood, and there are too many bodies and it is too dark to pick him out. Hak Sung calls for him again, peering into the mass. Down the street, a methane lamp burns bright, shattered, its neck spurting gas into the sky. Hak Sung supposes it could explode at any moment, ripping through the methane pipes of the city, but he can't muster the energy to care. He stares around at the bodies. Most of them are students, it seems, just foolish children. Trying to do battle with Megadonts, fools. He forces down memories of his own children, dead and piled. The massacres of Malaya writ on Thai pavement. He pries a spring gun from a dead white shirt's hands, checks its load. Only a few discs left, but still. He pumps the spring, adding energy, shoves it into his pocket. Children playing at war. Children who don't deserve to die, but are too foolish to live. In the distance, the battle rages still. Moved on to other avenues and other victims. Hak Sung limps down the street. Bodies lie everywhere. He reaches an intersection and hobbles across, too tired to care about the risk of being caught in the open. At the far side, a man lies slumped against a wall, his bicycle lying beside him. Blood soaks his lap. Hak Sung picks up the bicycle.
"That's mine,"
the man says. Hak Sung pauses, studying the man.
The man can barely keep his eyes open, yet still he clings to normalcy, to the idea that something like a bicycle can be owned. Hak-sung turns and wheels the bicycle down off the sidewalk. The man calls out again.
That's mine!
But he doesn't stand, and he doesn't do anything to stop Hak-sung, as he swings a leg over the frame and sets his feet on the pedals. If the man complains again, Hak-sung doesn't hear it. Chapter 41. I thought we weren't going to move for another 2 weeks. Anderson protests.
We don't have everything in place.
Plans must change. Your weapons and funding are still quite helpful. Akarat shrugs. In any case, having Farang shock troops in the city would not necessarily smooth the transition.
It's possible that this accelerated timetable is best.
Explosions rumble across the city. A methane fire is burning, bright and green, yellowing now as it finds dry bamboo and other materials. Akarat studies the burn, waves to the man with the radiophone. The private cranks at the power as Akarat speaks quietly, issuing orders for fire teams to be dispatched to the blaze. He glances at Anderson, explains.
If the fires get out of control, we won't have a city to defend.
Anderson studies the spreading fire. The gleam of Palace Chedi, the temple of the Emerald Buddha.
That fire's near the city pillar.
Cap.
We can't allow the pillar to burn. It would be a bad omen for a new regime that is supposed to be strong and forward-looking.
Anderson goes and leans on a balcony railing. His hand, splinted now, still throbs. But with the bone reset by a military doctor, it feels better than it has in hours. A swaddling layer of morphine helps keep the pain at bay. Another arc of fire crosses the sky. A missile that buries itself in the distance, somewhere in the Environment Ministry compound. It's hard to believe the forces that Akarat has mustered for his ascension. The man had far more power at his disposal than he let on. Anderson pretends nonchalance as he asks the next question.
I assume this accelerated schedule won't affect the specifics of our agreement?
Agrigen remains a favored partner in the new era. At these soothing words, Anderson relaxes, but Akarat's next sentence yanks him alert. Of course, the situation has changed somewhat. After all, you were unable to bring certain promised resources to bear.
Anderson looks at him sharply. We had a timetable. The promised troops are en route, along with more weapons and funding.
Akarat smiles slightly. Don't look so concerned. I'm sure we'll work something out.
We want the seed bank still.
Akarat shrugs.
I understand your position. Don't forget that Carlisle also has the pumps you'll need before the rainy season.
Akarat glances at Carlisle.
I'm sure separate arrangements can be made.
No!
Carlisle grins, glances from one to the other, then holds up his hands as he backs away.
You all work this out. It's not my argument.
Just so. Akarat turns back to the arrangements of the battle. Anderson watches, eyes narrowed. They still have leverage on this man. Guarantees of fertile, latest generation seed stock. Rice that will resist blister rust for at least a dozen plantings. He considers how best to affect Akarat, to bring him back into alignment. But the morphine and exhaustion of the last 24 hours are wearing on him. Smoke from one of the fires drift across them, sending everyone into coughing fits before the wind shifts again. More tracer fire and shells arc across the city, followed by the distant rumble of explosions. Carlisle frowns.
What was that?
Probably the army's Krut Company. Their commander refused our friendship offer. He'll be shelling the anchor pads on behalf of Pracha, Akarat says.
The White Shirts don't want to allow a resupply. They'll also go after the seawalls if we let them.
But the city would drown.
And it would be our fault,
Akarat grimaces.
In the December 12 coup, the dikes were barely defended successfully. If Pracha feels he is losing, and by now he must know he is, then the White Shirts may try to take the city hostage to force a more favorable surrender.
He shrugs.
It's a pity we don't already have your coal pumps delivered.
As soon as the shooting stops, Carlisle says, I'll contact Calcutta and ship them out.
I would have expected no less.
Akarat's teeth gleam. Anderson fights to keep the scowl off his own face. He doesn't like their friendly banter. It's almost as if their earlier captivity is forgotten, and Carlisle and Akarat are old friends. He doesn't like the way Akarat seems to have separated Anderson's own interests from Carlisle's. Anderson studies the landscape, mulling his options. If he just knew the location of the seed bank, he could order a strike team to move in and take it in the confusion of this urban war. Shouts filter up from below. People milling in the streets, all of them looking toward the havoc. All of them curious what this warfare bodes for them. He follows the gaze of the confused throng. Old expansion towers stand black amongst the fires, bits of remnant glass windows twinkling merrily with the blazes all around. Beyond the city and the fires, the black ocean ripples, a sheet of darkness. From high up, the seawalls seem curiously insubstantial. A ring of gas lights, and then nothing beyond except hungry blackness.
Can they really breach the dikes?
He asks. Akarat shrugs.
There are weak points. We had planned to defend them with additional Navy personnel from the south, but we think we can hold.
And if you don't?
The man who allows the city to drown will never be forgiven,
Akarat says.
It cannot be allowed. We will fight for the dikes as if we are the villages of Bang Rajan.
Anderson watches the burning fires and the sea beyond. Carlisle leans on the railing beside him. His face glimmers in the light. He has the satisfied smile of a man who cannot lose. Anderson leans over.
Akarat might have influence here, but Agrigen is everywhere else.
He locks eyes with the traitor.
Remember that.
He's pleased to see Carlisle's smile falter. More gunfire echoes across the landscape. From high up, the battle lacks visceral power. It's a battle of ants fighting over piles of sand. As if someone has kicked two nests together to test the clash of trivial civilizations. Mortars rumble. Fires twinkle and flare. In the distance, a shadow descends from the black night overhead. A dirigible sinking toward the city blazes. It floats low over the fires, and suddenly a portion of a blaze winks out as a deluge of seawater pours from its belly. Akarat watches, smiling.
Ours, he says.
And then, as though the fire is not snuffed but actually airborne, the dirigible explodes. Flames roar around it, pieces of its skin blazing and peeling off, fluttering away as the whole great beast sinks toward the city and crashes to pieces on the buildings.
Christ,
Anderson says.
You sure you don't want our reinforcements now?
Akarat's face remains impassive.
I didn't think they would have time to deploy missiles. A massive explosion rocks the city. Green gas burning bright, rising at the skyline's edge. A cloud of flame roiling and expanding. Unimaginable pounds of compressed gas going up in a roaring green mushroom. The Environment Ministry's strategic reserve, I think. Akarat comments. Beautiful. Carlyle murmurs. Fucking beautiful.
Chapter 42. Hak-sung shelters in an alley as tanks and trucks rumble down Tanon Posri. He shudders at the thought of the fuel burning. It has to be much of the kingdom's diesel stock, all of it going up in a single orgy of violence. Coal smoke fills the air as stoked tanks surge past on clanking treads. Hak-sung crouches in garbage. Everything he planned has fallen apart in this moment of crisis. Instead of waiting and moving north as a careful unit, he left his valuables to burn for the sake of one long-shot risk.
Quit complaining, you old fool. You would have roasted your purple bot and your yellow card friends all together if you hadn't left when you did.
Still, he wishes he'd had the forethought to bring at least some of that carefully squirreled insurance. He wonders if his karma is so broken that he cannot ever truly hope to succeed. He peers into the street again. The Spring Life offices are within view. Best of all, there are no guards present. Hak-sung allows himself a smile at that. The white shirts have their own troubles now. He wheels the bicycle across the street, using it as a crutch to keep him upright. Inside the compound, it looks as though there was brief fighting. A trio of bodies lie against a wall, seemingly executed. Their yellow armbands have been pulled off and tossed in the dust beside them. More foolish children playing at politics.
Movement behind him.
Hak-sung turns and jams his spring gun into his stalker. Mai gasps as his gun barrel buries itself in her guts, mules with fear, eyes wide.
What are you doing here?
Hak-sung whispers. Mai stumbles back from his gun.
I came to look for you. The white shirts found our village. People are sick there.
She sobs.
And then your house burned.
For the first time he sees the soot and cuts covering her body.
You are in Yawarat, in the slums?
He asks, shocked. She nods.
I was lucky.
She fights back a sob. Hak-sung shakes his head.
Why come here?
I couldn't think of any other place.
And more people are sick.
She nods, fearful.
The white shirts questioned us. I didn't know what to do. I told...
Don't worry.
Hak-sung sets a soothing hand on her shoulder.
The white shirts won't trouble us anymore. They have their own problems.
Do you have...
She stops. Finally says...
They burned our village. Everything.
She is a pathetic creature. So small, so vulnerable. He imagines her fleeing her destroyed home, seeking refuge in the only place left to her. And then finding herself in the heart of warfare. A part of him wants to be rid of her burden, but too many have already died around him, and he is obscurely pleased for her company. He shakes his head.
Foolish child.
He motions her into the factory.
Come with me.
A furious stink envelops them as they enter the main hall. They both cover their faces, breathing shallowly.
The algae baths.
Hak-sung murmurs.
The kink springs have stopped running the fans. Nothing is being vented.
He climbs the steps to the office, shoves open the door. The room is close and hot and reeks as badly as the manufacturing floor from the long days without airflow.
He pushes open shutters, letting in night breeze and city burn. Across the roofs, flames flicker, sparking in the night like prayers going up to heaven. Mai comes to stand beside him, her face illuminated in the irregular glow. A gas lamp is burning freely down in the street, broken. They must be burning all over the city. Haksung is somewhat surprised that no one has cut off the gas lines. Someone should have done it already, and yet still this one flares, bright and green, reflecting on Mai's face. She is pretty, he realizes, slight and beautiful. An innocent trapped amongst warring animals. He turns from the window and goes to squat before the safe. Studies its dials and heavy locks, its combinations and levers. Expensive to manufacture something with so much steel. When he had his own company, when the Tri-Clipper ruled the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean, he had one like it in his offices. An heirloom, salvaged from an old bank when it lost liquidity. Straight from the vault, and carried into Three Prosperities Trading Company with the help of two megadonts. This one sits before him, taunting him. He must destroy it at its joints. It will take time. Come with me, he says. He leads her back down to the factory floor. Mai hangs back when he wants to go into the fining rooms. He hands her a line worker's mask. It should be enough.
You're sure?
He shrugs.
Stay then.
But she follows him anyway, back to where they store the curing acid. They walk gingerly. He uses a rag to push aside the fining room curtains, careful to let nothing touch him. His breath is loud inside the mask, ragged sawing. The manufacturing rooms are disarrayed. White shirts have been here inspecting. The stink of the rotting algae tanks is intense, even through the mask. Haksung breathes shallowly, forcing himself not to gag. Overhead, the drying screens are all black with withered algae. A few streamers dangle down, black, emaciated tentacles. Haksung fights the urge to duck from them.
What are you doing?
My pants.
Looking for a future.
He spares her small smile before he realizes she can't see his expressions through the mask. He digs gloves out of a supply cabinet and hands her a pair. Gives her an apron as well.
Help me with this.
He indicates a sack of powder.
We're working for ourselves now. No more foreign influences, yes?
He stops her as she reaches for the sack.
Don't get any on your skin, he says. And don't let your sweat touch it.
He guides her back up to the offices.
What is it?
You shall see, child.
Yes, but...
It's magic. Now go get some water from the Glong out back.
When she returns, he takes a knife and carefully slices into the sacking.
Bring me the water.
She pulls the bucket close. He dips into the water with his knife, then runs it through the powder. The powder hisses and begins to boil. When he takes the knife out, it's half gone, melted into nothing, still hissing. Mai's eyes go wide. A viscous liquid pours off the knife.
What is it?
A specialized bacteria. Something the Farang have created.
Not acid, though.
No. It's alive, in a way.
He takes the knife and begins to scrape it along the face of the safe. The knife disintegrates completely. Haksung grimaces.
I need something else. Something long to spray it with.
Put water on the safe.
Mai suggests.
Then pour on the powder.
He laughs.
Clever child.
Soon the safe is soaking. He prepares a paper funnel and lets the powder stream through in a tiny fountain.
Wherever it touches the metal face, it begins to boil. Hak Sung steps back, horrified at the speed of the stuff, fights the urge to wipe his hands.
Don't get any on your skin,
he mutters, stares at his gloves. If there is a trace of powder on them and they are wetted, his skin crawls. Mai is already backed away to the far side of the office, watching with terrified eyes. Metal pours off the face. Eaten and discarded iron peeling away in sheaves, layers of it flaking away as if blown by autumn winds. The bright leaves of melting iron land on teak flooring. They hiss and spread. The flakes burn on, creating a lattice of broken seared wood.
It doesn't stop,
Mai says, awed. Hak Sung watches with increasing unease, wondering if the yeast-like stuff will eat away the floor below and send the safe crashing down into the manufacturing lines. He finds his voice.
It is alive. It should lose its ability to digest soon.
This is what the Farang make?
Mai's voice is frightened and awed.
Our people have made such things as well.
Hak Sung shakes his head.
Don't think the Farang are so much as all that.
The safe continues to disintegrate. If only he had been brave before. He could have done this when there wasn't a war boiling outside the window. He wishes he could go back in time to his former frightened, paranoid self, so worried about deportation, about angering foreign devils, about preserving his good name, and simply whisper in that old man's ear that there was no hope, that he should steal and run, and it could not turn out worse. A voice interrupts his thoughts.
Well, well, Tan Hak Sung. How nice to see you here.
Hak Sung turns. Dogfucker and Old Bones, along with six others, are standing in the doorway. All of them carrying spring guns. They're scratched and sooted from the warfare of the streets, but smiling and confident.
We all seem to have been thinking along the same lines,
Dogfucker observes. An explosion lights the sky, casting orange across the office. The rumble of destruction trembles through Hak Sung's souls. It's hard to tell how far away it was. The shells seem to fall randomly. If there is intelligence guiding them, it's not for them to understand. Another rumble, this one closer. The white shirts defending the levees, most likely. Hak Sung fights an urge to flee. The cracking of the iron-digesting bacteria continues. Leaves of metal waft to the floor. Hak Sung tests the waters.
I'm glad you're here. Help me then, come on.
Old Bone smiles.
I think not.
The men shoulder past Hak Sung, all of them larger than he, all of them armed. All of them uncaring of his and Mai's presence. Hak Sung staggers as they bump him aside.
But it's mine,
he protests.
You can't take it. I told you where it was.
The men ignore him.
You can't take it!
Hak Sung fumbles for his gun. Suddenly, a pistol presses against his skull. Old Bone smiling. Dogfucker watches with interest.
Another killing will make little difference on my rebirth. Don't test me.
Hak Sung can barely control his rage. A part of him wants to fire anyway to steal away the man's smug expression. The safe's metal continues to bubble and hiss, falling away, slowly revealing his last object of hope. The Nak Lung all watch Hak Sung and Old Bones. They're loose, smiling, unafraid. They haven't even lifted their pistols. They simply watch, interested as Hak Sung points his pistol at them. Dogfucker grins.
Go away, Yellow Card.
before I change my mind.
Mai tugs at Hak Sung's hand.
Whatever it isn't worth your life.
She's right, Yellow Card,
Old Bone says.